You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good afternoon, everybody. I am Commander Tom Garcia, and this is the American Hour. Thank you for joining us on the USA Talk Radio Network, or some of you may be joining us through Blog Talk. And, of course, my lovely co-host, Paula Lauzon Osman. How are you today, Paula?
Doing great, Tom. How are you?
Good, good, good. Yeah, we're going to have to change that intro. When I originally had my wife record that, it was just me doing the show. We got to get her to add your name in on that. But everybody knows that. Everybody that's listened to the show knows that you're on the show co-host as well. So we'll get that changed one of these days.
No worries.
And I know. So anyway, hey, I'm broadcasting live from Lima, Peru. And I'm staying at the lovely and exotic, quite honestly, it's a very nice hotel, the Thunderbird Prado Hotel in Lima, Peru. And I've got a suite here, Paula. You know, the thing about this Lima trip, I like Lima, but I always liked it. But I haven't been here in 6 years. The airport didn't recognize it. It's a whole new airport. They were building a new airport when I used to fly here, but it was never completed before I stopped flying here. The reason I haven't flown here in so long is the trip value, you know, it eats up 3 days of my time. I left yesterday, fairly late, but yesterday it was an all-nighter down. Nobody likes having to do all-nighters, and it's not a three-man crew because it's only about a five-and-a-half-hour flight, so it was just a two-man crew in a 757. I normally fly the 767. And then we'll leave early tomorrow morning and get back, you know, like 2:30 in the afternoon. Which, by the way, I need to let people know. Tomorrow, we were going to attempt to do some form of broadcasting. I took the train down, which means I'd have to be broadcasting on the train. That's not going to work, especially during rush hour or middle of the afternoon. So I haven't picked one yet, but I'm going to pick a best of. Unless, Paula, you would like to broadcast on your own tomorrow.
If I'm up for that, yes, Tom.
Okay. I could probably call in, and you know, it wouldn't be the usual show because I'm going to be on a train full of people. I guess I could get some of the people on the train involved if they're interested, but I could have a bunch of sourpusses on the train too, so that might not work. But anyway, we're going to pick a best of. We got a lot of the shows that we've done in the past. We did that once with Winston Scott, the astronaut.
Yeah.
So I'll pick something that's done well in the past. That'll be a best of show tomorrow. Apologize, everybody, but that's just the way it's going to be. I won't be getting home till about 5:30. Even if we slid the show a little bit, it'll just be getting late. And so another note here. I am broadcasting from the hotel Wi-Fi. Don't even have an Ethernet cable, but quite honestly, it's coming through pretty good compared to some of the hotels I've been in with an Ethernet cable. So bear with us in case we have any technical difficulties. I don't foresee that. And in any case, I'd fly down here to Lima more often, but so I explained to you how it basically eats up about 3 days of my life, and it's worth flying time, what I get paid. I only get paid for the hours I fly. I don't get paid for all the other hours I work. It's just the hours I fly. 11 hours. It's worth 11 hours for 3 days. I mean, we got plenty of trips that are 2 days that are 10 hours. But my trips to Madrid next month, for example, they're 3 days. They leave around dinner time and get back same thing in the afternoon on the third day. And they're worth 18 hours of pay. So, it's just not worth it coming down here. But now I'm being told that in October we'll start leaving earlier, so it'll make the trip worth more, not a whole lot more. So I may do a few more in the future, but I went out and had some ceviche today, as they say down here, ceviche, and it was okay. I went into a little kind of hole in the wall, and I may tonight after I go out, do a little more shopping, hit another place. I love ceviche. I really do, especially the sea bass version. I mean, they make it with all kinds of different, you know, seafoods, but I love to just get straight sea bass. It's almost like eating some kind of a sushi because it's so tender and soft. So I had a big plate of that, and I may do that again tonight, but it's been, like I said, 6 years. And there's something different about ceviche in Peru. It's just not the same anywhere else. So I'm enjoying it, but I don't know how much more often I come down. But yeah, it's a nice, very nice hotel. I've got a flat panel TV in the living room and another one in the bedroom. And, I know. It's like I got a kitchen and a microwave, and I don't just even know what to do with myself here. It's impressive. So yeah, it's like a little mini vacation. If I hadn't had to fly all night to get here last night, boy, you know, I'm used to when I do the all-nighters, having a three-man crew and getting to take a two-and-a-half-hour break somewhere in there. But, well, that's life. But anyways, we're going to kick off the show, as we said yesterday, with a little sound clip of Gene Simmons being interviewed. And it was on, I believe, CNBC is where he was being interviewed. And we get talking about a little bit of his political philosophy. I realize he's not maybe the best guy in the world to be taking advice from on life, et cetera, but he is a wealthy guy, and he does have a very straightforward way of talking about things. So without any further ado, here's Gene Simmons on CNBC.
What do you think of President Obama's suggestion that the borders be redrawn
President Obama, and I voted for an idea. What I didn't realize what I was getting was an idealist. If you've never been to the moon, you can't issue policy about the moon. You have no idea what it's like on the moon. For a president to be sitting in Washington, D.C. and saying, go back to your 67 borders in Israel, how about you live there and try to defend an indefensible border 9 miles wide? On one side, you've got hundreds of millions of people who hate your guts. On the other side, you've got the Mediterranean. Unless you control, in Israel, unless you control those Golan Heights, it's an indefensible position. It's a nice idea. When you grow up, you find out that life isn't the way you imagined it. And President Obama means well. I think he's actually a good guy. He has no idea what the world is like because he doesn't have to live there. That's why President Netanyahu, whose brother led the Entebbe raid and died, crossing country lines, breaking international law, landed in Idi Amin's territory, killed the local policeman, and freed those Europeans who were abducted by Idi Amin and crossed back to Israel. The UN condemned it. You broke airspace. What would have happened if you go to the UN, most pathetic body on the face of the planet? By the way, America invented UN after the League of Nations was a disaster. This is a paper tiger. We allow dictators to get up there and spread propaganda from Hugo Chavez to Gaddafi. It's garbage infested. And then when they want more money, they put their hand out to America. You all agree with every word I say. You know it. The biggest pacifist who's against the death penalty will immediately want to kill somebody who's got a gun to his mother. You walk in a room, you happen to come back from hunting or whatever, and there's somebody there. You don't want to find out why that person is deranged or if he's on crack. You want to kill him.
You know,
let's settle down.
Yeah.
Let's talk about it. You should have a trial by jury. You and the courts you wrote in, you're going to die, pal. Death on the spot. It's justice. I like that. You break into my house
it's
with a gun, I will kill you.
It's sort of Sharia law.
It's not. Women should be in charge, like the insect kingdom. You're much brighter than we are. You should have thousands of babies and be in charge.
You have my vote, except for the thousands of babies.
You,
yeah,
at least,
I don't need to have
at least,
thousands.
At least,
I had two.
At least practice thousands of times.
There you go, Paul. Well, he hit all my favorite topics there, from Obama being completely naive and in over his head, to the UN being an outhouse, to, let's see, what else? Go ahead.
Go, Gene. Guy never ceases to amaze.
Yeah, and if anybody's listening, they don't know who Gene Simmons is. He's the bass player and one of the vocalists for the band Kiss. And you notice how his and then, of course, he got the gun rights and death penalty. He threw those in there. I mean, he got everything in there. I think it was supposed to be talking about Obama's speech referring to the 67 border, which, by the way, I want to make a very important point. It's not a border that existed in 67. What they have today is the border in 67. That's what they fought for. They were attacked repeatedly, and that's what the territory they won, which has given them more security. They haven't been attacked in a long time because they've been able to expand their borders. What Gene Simmons and the media are really talking about is a border from 1949, right after they claimed statehood. Much, much smaller than 67. So you either say pre-67. Well, what would pre-67 be? Would that be like 2000 BC? No. What we're referring to is basically what the borders were in Israel in 1949. That's what our president, the genius, said, let's go back to. That is the biggest violation of negotiation protocol, is to take something that big and make it your starting point. Let me give you a perfect example, Paula. Let's say you're going to buy a used car, and from a person, not a dealer or anything like that, and you know what you'd like to pay. You think if you could pay $2,000, it would be a good deal. Now, we don't know what this person is thinking. This person might be thinking, boy, if I could get $2,000, that would be great. So in reality, you could maybe get it for $1,500. But if you start off at something above your what you want to start at, $2,000, let's say you were to come in there and say, this is really what I want to pay $2,000. First of all, you'd be dumb to start at $2,000. You'd want to start at $1,000 and have this person work you up. But this is what Obama did. He walked in and said, in not his thinking, but what the world would on either side, $2,000 is what the Israelis want to pay, and quite honestly, the Palestinians are willing to pay $2,000. He walked in and threw on the table, here's our starting point, $3,000. That's the kind of naive idiot he is. That's what he did with this whole negotiation process. That was absolutely ridiculous and dangerous, and really threw them under the bus. Now, what was the Palestinians' position? The Palestinians weren't fighting for specific territory. They don't care what the Palestinian state looks like. They want right of return to the entire country. So let's just say we went along with what the president said. Okay, 1949 borders. So we give everything back, and that'll, now we give everything back to who? It wasn't the Palestinians. It was Jordan and Syria and Egypt. So we're going to give it back to those countries. Well, the Palestinians still don't have a state. Are those countries willing to give up that territory now to give the Palestinians? Or did the president mean but didn't say, we're going to go back to those borders, except the land doesn't return to those countries. It's going to be donated to the Palestinians. I mean, this guy can never give us any specifics. Anyway, let's just say that that's what it's going to be. All that territory is not going to be returned to 1949 borders. It's going to be given to the Palestinians. That's not their big issue. Their big issue is right of return. So you can give them that and that, say, this is the whole Palestinian state. They're still going to say, we want right of return to the entire nation of Israel. And if you're listening out there, you don't understand what that means that the Palestinians can come into anywhere in Israel and reside. They want right of return as if it's their country. In other words, they want to make it their country as well. And the problem is there will be more Palestinians living in Israel than Israelis. So guess what? It's no longer Israel. The whole thing becomes Palestine. I mean, that's why they've been pushing all these years for right of return, because they could turn the entire state of Israel, regardless of a named Palestinian state, they could turn the entire state of Israel into Palestine. And so here's an example of how that would work, say, in the United States. We've got some of these radical racist groups that want to take back some of the southwestern states, which never did belong to Mexico to begin with, but in any case, want to take that back. And what if we said to the Mexicans, I tell you what, you want right of return? Come on in, and you'll have full voting rights and citizenship rights and everything else, land rights, everything. And all of a sudden, and I know this is way too big an example, it would never work this way, but let's just say that we as Americans only had 10 million, there were only 10 million of us in the U.S., and 30 million Mexicans came into the U.S. and suddenly were citizens. Would it be the United States of America anymore? No, it would be the United States of Mexico. We'd be outnumbered. So that's the problem. Right of return will never happen. Will never happen. So did the president say anything in his speech about right of return's got to be dropped, or we've got to come up with some solution to that, maybe some portion of right of return for some people, but it can't be pure right of return. He didn't throw the Palestinians under the bus on their big issue, but the Israelis, yes, he did. So he's a terrible negotiator, number one, or he hates Israel and wanted to throw him under the bus. Either way is not a good solution. There's no way out of this. There's no way to say, oh, well, he's a really smart negotiator. Please, somebody call in and tell me how that was a smart negotiation tactic. Please call me and tell me that. It's the dumbest, most amateurish negotiation tactic I've ever seen. And what did he say about it? He said, well, I want to jumpstart talks. Jumpstart talks with a non-starter. That's what he said, essentially. I want to jumpstart talks with a non-starter. It's a non-starter. It'll never happen. So anyway, there's Gene Simmons, and he started off talking about one thing, and notice how he always gets around to somehow sex in the end. Did you notice that, Paula?
Yeah, I kind of picked that up towards the end a little bit.
he always gets around to that. And I think somehow he always insists on having an interviewer be a woman. But there we have it. All right. Let's see. Go ahead.
That's just how he is.
Yeah. All right. I picked this out as my a vomit article of the day. And this came out, you know, that the president's been over touring Europe and yucking it up about his Irish heritage and all this kind of stuff while we have tornadoes destroying, you know, the Midwest and more of them on their way. And he says, I'll be back on Sunday. How about you come back today, sir, instead of running around playing politics? And I mean, what's more important, glad-handing and giving pontificating, downward-talking speeches in other countries? Yeah, that's really what's most important to him. He loves being in front of a teleprompter or coming home and seeing what's going on here and taking some action here at home. No, we're with you. You know, he in his speech. We're with you. We're fully behind you. Meanwhile, I continue my tour of my vacation tour of Europe. Yeah. Okay. But this was I'd just gotten back from lunch, and I read this, and I just about lost it. Thank goodness there was a sink nearby. These two leaders, David Cameron, Prime Minister of Great Britain, and our President Barack Obama, had compared themselves in their personal efforts to two leaders that came before them that got along well, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. Oh, my gosh. Well, my first comment is this. Okay, David Cameron, maybe if you like cross-dressing in private, I could say, okay, you remind me of Margaret Thatcher. But Barack Obama of Ronald Reagan, he's the antithesis of Ronald Reagan. He's the exact opposite of Ronald Reagan. I mean, look what he's done. He's grown government at an astronomical rate. And one of the most famous quotes of Ronald Reagan was, government's not the solution, it's the problem. And yet, remember when Barack Obama told us that the only thing that's going to get us out of this recession and keep us from going into depression is government. In other words, government's the solution. Only government can save us. And then I was thinking about maybe playing that soundbite we had played quite some time ago about the president saying that jobs, government jobs, are the most important job in the world. Now, you would never hear Reagan say anything like this. So to compare himself to Reagan, now I know what people say, well, in his efforts, what efforts? The guy plays golf every weekend. The guy's a no-show at too many important things. And what's he actually done? I want somebody to tell me what he's done. What they're going to say is something that can never be measured. It's, well, he saved us from a depression, and he saved jobs. Somebody prove to me how you can prove that you saved jobs. You can't. Well, we've lost jobs, millions of jobs. And
yep.
The vast majority of jobs have been created, and we had this on the show last week, Paula, is that the vast majority of jobs created in, I think it was 2010, were government jobs. Non-producing, taxpayer-funded government jobs. Wow. So he's created jobs, government jobs. And again, Reagan, government's not the solution, it's the problem. So let's just hear what Barack Obama's philosophy is on government jobs. And remember, this is a woman who had a government job, lost it, and she was talking to the president about it, and he references his feelings for what she's going through and how working for the government is really the most important thing there is.
Workers like you for the federal, state, and local governments are so important for our vital services. And it frustrates me sometimes when people talk about government jobs as if somehow those are worth less than private sector jobs. I think there's nothing more important than working on behalf of the American people.
Nothing more important. No, I think there's something way more important. The American people working on behalf of the American people. Oh, boy. So that's why I just about lost it. To compare himself to Ronald Reagan in any way whatsoever is the hugest stretch of the imagination that it just made me ill. It made me ill. But, and again, here's a guy who's incumbent. So I'm gonna kick things off here, Paula, and then we're going to get back to you on we talked about this earlier, about what's going on with Israel in some articles that you found today. But here we go. I'm going to go back to 2010, and I just want to highlight the incompetence of this president, and again, being nothing like Ronald Reagan. But he was at the University of Nevada, and here's what he had to say about the economy. He said, in the situation that we were in, of course, he got handed an ugly economy. There's no doubt about that. But let's analyze that a little bit. His portrayal of what had happened was absolutely inaccurate. He said all these were consequences of a decade of misguided economic policies, a decade of stagnant wages, a decade of declining incomes, a decade of spiraling deficits. Now I want to analyze this little statement here for a second. Misguided economic policies. He said a decade of stagnant wages. Stagnant wages are the result of an economy, not the cause of an economy. A decade of declining incomes is the result of an economy, not the cause of it. But see, he's got to get his sound bites in there. He's got to talk to the masses and go, stagnant wages, declining incomes, oh, boo-hoo. You know, everybody out there, is paying a terrific price because of misguided economic policies. And then the icing on the cake is spiraling deficits. So the first two, decade of stagnant wages and declining incomes, I don't necessarily know about that. But let's just say, okay, that's fine. Well, that was a result of the economy. And we'll analyze that. But that's playing to the crowd. That has nothing to do with economic policy. Paul, have you ever seen a president or a Congress come out and say, we have come up with our new economic policy for 2012. Our economic policy for 2012 is stagnant wages and declining incomes.
No.
I mean, that's what he said. He said misguided economic policies. And then
right.
He goes stagnant wages. Nobody has economic policies that are focused on stagnant wages and declining incomes. It's
uh-huh.
It's something else, something that's above his head that he doesn't understand. You know, policies that are either raising taxes, policies that are raising corporate taxes, policies that are allowing federal agencies to increase regulation that stifles economic growth. Those are reasons why the economy could be bad, and resulting of that are stagnant wages and declining incomes. But for him to understand what would cause stagnant wages and declining incomes, that's above his head. So that's the only thing he can focus on. But let's take a look at spiraling deficits. Now, this came out in July 2010 by Keith Hennessy, the Daily Caller. He had a graph showing the deficits over the 8 years, and actually then the ninth year, the year after George Bush, to highlight the fact that there were no spiraling deficits. He said instead of 8 years of deficits, it was instead 8 years of deficits averaging 2% of GDP, followed by a horrible ninth year as markets collapsed and the economy plunged into recession. Even 2008's bigger deficit than 2007 can mostly be explained by a revenue decline as the economy slipped into recession. So the economy was slipping into a recession. It wasn't economic policies that caused a bigger deficit. It's the budget was the same. In other words, we're spending the same amount for the government to run as the previous year. We have an expanded government. We're spending the same amount. There's just less revenue coming in. Okay, so before the crash of late 2008, President Bush's budget deficits were 0.6% percentage points smaller than the historic average. Does that sound like spiraling deficits? Spiraling out of control when he's below the historic average. Deficits did not spiral during the Bush presidency or the decade. They bumped around the historic average, then spiked up in the last year. What happened the year after President Clinton left office? Same exact thing. The same exact thing. Deficit jumped up, and the economy took a tank. Did anybody say, oh, it was a spiraling deficits and misguided economic policies? No, everybody applauds President Clinton for, 8 years of wonderful economy. And then how do you have 8 years of wonderful economy and then the day a new president takes over, everything just starts falling apart? There isn't time to implement policies to affect that. So clearly there were some policies that were implemented in the Clinton administration that caused the follow-on recession. And sometimes it may have nothing to do with what the government's. The reality is we don't want the government controlling our economy. Everybody seems to believe that whatever decisions the government makes affects the economy. Certainly it does. But that's not the only factor. There are world factors. There are industry factors and technology factors. But anyway, so let's see. But even though the horrible 8.3% increase In 2009, when President Bush left office, that figure is a combination of a severe decline in federal revenues as the economy tanked, plus the projected costs of TARP. Remember, we came up with TARP to save our banks, thanks to Barney Frank and Chris Dodd. We had to come up with the TARP program. If we included the terrible ninth year in the Bush average, and this author thinks we should, so that his 8 years plus the following year, because he kind of owns that following year, then the average Bush deficit is still only 2.7%, one-tenth of a percentage point above the average over the past four decades. Okay, and this all comes from CBO's historic tables. So just barely slightly above. Look and see what it's now just in the last 2 years under this president. Take away his first year when, you know, we'll give it to Bush. See what's happened in the last 2 years. Oh, it makes what happened to Bush, what Bush left behind in 2009 look like a drop in the bucket.
Great.
So there, and he wraps it up by saying, there is therefore a big difference between a decade of failure and 7 years of pretty good, followed by a disaster in year eight. There's a huge difference. So when he said spiraling deficits, there were no spiraling deficits. I've seen the charts as well. I've seen other charts, and they just kind of muddled along, and there was a variation, but not a significant variation. And the most we ever hit during those 8 years under George Bush was about $400 billion annual deficit. We now know that Obama's running $1.5 trillion deficits, and that's his new baseline. Remember, he said when he took over, deficits may run at $1 trillion for many, many years. And now he's saying, now it's got to be $1.5 trillion. So we're in a whole new world. The media loves to ignore the facts and try and portray this administration as doing good stuff, when in fact every number, every benchmark that you look at shows that this administration is horribly worse than any past administration in the last four decades. So, and I'm going to go talk a little bit about our president and how he uses this false choice paradigm in his speeches. So, he, again, as I said earlier in the show, he gives us no substance, and doesn't tell us the truth. I've given you two examples now of him not telling us the truth and exaggerating things to the point where they're meaningless. But let's focus on Israel. Now, that was the article you pulled up today, wasn't it, Paula, on Netanyahu's speech to the Congress and what came out of that?
Yes, what came out of that is I just picked something else up after the speech, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed the joint meeting of Congress today in Capitol Hill in Washington, and he laid out a vision for Middle East peace that said he would include an unspecified far-reaching compromise by Israel if the Palestinians accept his country as a Jewish vote. Obama had said recently that the bond between Israel and the United States is unbreakable, that his position was misrepresented, and he says the 67 lines should be a starting point for talks. In a speech punctuated by standing ovations from supportive U.S. lawmakers, Netanyahu repeated his insistence that Israel would not accept a return to indefensible borders that existed before the 67 Arab-Israeli war. And he ruled out allowing Palestinian refugees to return to Israel or giving up any part of Jerusalem. He also vowed that Israel would not negotiate with a Palestinian government that includes the Islamist militant group Hamas, which controls the Gaza Strip and recently reconciled with the Fatah administration in the West Bank. He blamed the Palestinians for failure to end the long-running conflict so far, saying that they've been unwilling to accept a Palestinian state if it meant accepting a Jewish state alongside it. In the West Bank, a spokesman for Abbas said there was nothing new in the speech, which he cast as a rebuff to President Obama. Another Abbas aide said Netanyahu's terms amount to a declaration of war on the Palestinians, which was reported by the Associated Press. Palestinian acceptance of a Jewish state, Netanyahu said the Israeli people will be prepared to make a far-reaching compromise, and that he would be prepared to make a far-reaching compromise. He said he stressed that such a compromise must reflect the dramatic demographic changes that have occurred since 1967, which meant that Israeli's final borders must include densely populated Israeli settlements in the West Bank, as well as other places of critical strategic and national importance to Israel. And without going into detail, he had pledged to be generous about the area of a future Palestinian state. Now, immediately after this occurred, I'm not sure if you're aware, Vice President Biden did not applaud Netanyahu after he had said that Jerusalem would not be divided. It was visible to all what had occurred, and that's pretty much all I have on that. But he was, from what I understand, he was the only one that didn't applaud Netanyahu's speech this afternoon.
Yeah, that's not surprising at all. What a piece of work he is.
Yep.
We've got let's play our favorite clip of Joe, the dumb as a doornail Biden, explaining. let me see if I can find it here. Maybe we don't have it anymore. I thought we still had that. Yeah, here we do. On waterboarding. He sounds like he's on antidepressants or Quaaludes or something like that. I'm not really sure, but he's been asking about waterboarding.
Ever envision a time when waterboarding should be used on anyone?
No. It's not effective. Correct. It's not effective.
Let's talk them.
What an idiot. No. It's not effective. No. Gosh. What a presence. And he thinks he's going to run for president in 2016? Oh, my gosh. He is as deluded as anybody could possibly be. He thinks Elvis is still alive and playing in Vegas, I think. Oh, geez, Louise. Yeah, waterboarding is effective. It's absolutely effective. And it's not torture. When I went through SEER training, I didn't get waterboarded, and only a few of us did. But those that did, they explained to us what it was like. It's effective. You'll sing like a bird, and you'll tell them what they want to know, and it doesn't cause any harm, and it doesn't hurt anybody. What John McCain went through was abusive, gross torture. He can't raise his arms above his shoulders, let alone above his head. That's torture. Waterboarding somebody, you know, they made us sit up all night. You better not fall asleep. They come in and slap you around. They're playing Black Sabbath backwards loudly at night, you know, and you're sitting there shivering up in the mountains. Did that scar anybody for life? No, it was no fun. It's called interrogation is what it is. Torture is you can hurt somebody without getting any information from them. You can get all the information you want and still hurt them. Interrogation, enhanced interrogation. If somebody wants to tell you the truth and give you the information, they don't have to go through the waterboarding or anything else. So anyway, Joe Biden has been proven wrong now, absolutely wrong. That entire administration is proven wrong. Waterboarding does work. It is effective. And whenever Joe Biden says something, nope, that doesn't work, or yes, that does work, we know he's always wrong. He's never, ever right. But, you know, that was a good article, and I saw that today. I found some information on this as well. You know, and when the president made his speech, he claimed that past administrations have also supported the pre-1967 border. So I'm going to stress that. In fact, I'm going to call it the 1949 border because it's not a 67 border. What they have today is a 67 border, but the 1949 border. And President Bush made it very clear in a 2004 letter that the United States supported Israel's claims on Jerusalem and the major settlement blocks. Obama is neutral about Israel's borders, and that's why the Palestinians view his support of pre-67 or 1949 borders as a green light for them to refuse to talk. And you just read it in the article. They refuse to talk now unless Israel agrees to surrender every inch of territory. And as I said at the beginning of the show, if Israel were to say, okay, we're going to give all that land back, it doesn't go to the Palestinians. They didn't have it to begin with. It goes to Syria, Jordan, and Egypt. Now the question is, will Syria, Jordan, Egypt give it to? I guarantee you, as Steve Rosenblum, our good friend, said last week, if we give the Golan Heights back to Syria, they're not giving that to anybody, and they're going to use that as a strategic military advantage, as they have in the past, over Israel. So that can't ever be given back. And if we were to give it to the Palestinians, they certainly would allow the Syrians to move right on in with the rocket launchers and tanks and et cetera, and have that wonderful view looking right down on Israel. So it's a non-starter. It's a non-starter. And this president doesn't understand this stuff. It's over his head. He's in over his head. But let me continue. Obama's lecture about why Israel must make further concessions in spite of Arab intransigence was condescending and somewhat misleading. Obama said the demographics and technology mean the status quo can't be sustained. The demographics, and tell us what the demographics are, Mr. Obama. What's the technology? Please tell us. He can't go into any specifics. He never does. Can't be sustained, and implicitly accused Israel of procrastination. Israel's procrastinated. I seem to remember that they offered the Palestinians virtually all of the West Bank, part of Jerusalem, and Gaza. And they've been turned down on those offers twice. Even Netanyahu has made these offers to them and been turned down. So, again, he's either completely incompetent or he hates Israel. Because there's no way to not know this history and not know what has transpired. So I say again, and I had to say this many times in the military, if you find somebody who's either incompetent or doing something out of a lack of integrity, we'll call it that, a lack of integrity. In other words, they're violating some sort of protocol or rule, et cetera, because they knowingly are doing that. Neither is good. Incompetence is no good in the military. It's too dangerous a business to have incompetence running around driving tanks or flying F-14s like I did. And it's no good having flat hatters flying around in F-14s that are, you know, violating rules and regulations and not being safe. So this guy falls into one of the two categories. He's either incompetent or he knows what he's doing and he is very, very dangerous. Let's see. Supposedly the right-wing government... I just read that. Anyway, Israel, if you look at the record, Israel has been trying to make peace for 63 years. 63 years. And the right of return, the reason we have so many Palestinians, or they're really Arabs, but Arabs that want to return under right of return, and it's not just the ones that had to leave their homes. There were many, many Israelis, Jews, that had to leave as well. Because when they declared statehood in 1948, the wars broke out immediately. All of the Arabs surrounding countries said, no, you're not, and they went to war. So the Palestinians fled. They fled their homes. It wasn't like they ever got kicked out. The media portrays this as they got kicked out of Israel by the Israelis, and now they just want to come back. They just want to come back. No, they fled because their Arab brethren attacked, and they had to get out of there. So anyway, the right of return is a non-starter. President never talked about that. And, you know, as long as they refuse to negotiate, as long as the president refuses to acknowledge this right of return as being a non-starter, which would destroy Israel, then there will be no peace. And I don't know, maybe Obama doesn't want there to be peace. But you have any other thoughts on that, Paula?
Well, another article came out immediately afterwards that... An Abbas aide said that Netanyahu's speech to Congress is a declaration of war against the Palestinians. Nabil Shas, an aide to the Palestinian president Mahmoud Abbas, said that Netanyahu's insistence on keeping key parts of the territories the Palestinians state is a declaration of war against the Palestinians. And, you know, again, to reiterate for our listeners that don't know and understand, the Palestinians want to establish their state in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem areas Israel captured in the 67 Mideast War. And they have said that they are ready for minor border adjustments through land swaps to enable Israel to annex several of the largest of the dozens of Jewish settlements it has built on war-won land since 67. Abbas is set to meet with the leaders of the PLO and his Fatah movement on Wednesday to discuss their next move, and the Palestinians have developed an alternate strategy to moribund negotiations, largely on hold since 2008, and have said that they will seek UN recognition of their state in September. In two policy speeches in recent days, our president said that the pre-67 war line serve as the basis for negotiations while allowing for mutually agreed land swaps. The Palestinians have said negotiations can resume only if Netanyahu commits to that principle and halts settlement construction. In his speech, Netanyahu had demanded Abbas tear up his recent reconciliation agreement with Hamas, which seized Gaza 4 years ago and refuses to recognize Israel. Speaking on the same program, Shaul Mufaz, which is a leading member of the centrist opposition Kadima Party said Netanyahu just said over and over again that he doesn't intend to do anything. He doesn't have a plan and doesn't intend to reach an agreement. He warned that Netanyahu is bringing us toward conflict and said Israel would be best off holding new elections.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Well, there's an easy way to solve the problem. You just line up every Israeli tank and bulldozer and just shove them right out of there. Just get them out. You know, this is what bothers me, Paula. Paula, you live in Boston, and does anybody ever refer to Boston as the occupied territories of England? Because we
no.
did take it from England, didn't we?
Yeah, no, not that I'm aware of. Nobody's ever said that.
Right, when I was in South Texas, where my family name Garcia came from, and many of my family were ranchers going back to a time when that South Texas was owned by Mexico, I never heard anybody say that we lived in the occupied territories of Mexico. Some of our northern states, I don't hear anybody saying the occupied territories of France or Canada or Spain. But Louisiana, that's the occupied territories of the French, right? And the Floridas especially, you know, because they acted like they were giving it to us along with the Louisiana territories, but then they said, no, that's not a part of the deal. And so, hey, I live in Florida. I live in the occupied territories of France, which actually they gave it to Spain. So it was Spain's, and then France basically just took it back. So I don't know what occupied territories I live in, Paula. I either live in the occupied territories of Spain or France, but maybe I need to call up France, Sarkozy, and ask him, is this still the occupied territories of France, or did you allow Spain to keep it? Should I be calling Spain? This is just the biggest bunch of baloney I've ever seen in my life. Israel is Israel. It's not an occupied territory. It's a independent, sovereign nation, period. If you don't like it, too bad. That's what happens in war. You take land, and it's yours. And it's no longer occupied territories. Unbelievable. So, well, I found a really interesting article, Paula, Washington Post by Ruth Marcus, and she makes some good points, and it's not that Obama's the only one to do this, but it's just excessive. It just is getting old. It's his excessive use of the false choice paradigm in his speeches. Obama's supporters often praise his nuance, but as Marcus notes, the president is only nuanced if you believe that most people view arguments in extreme black or white terms. So what am I talking about? Well, listen. Go through this article and see. The false choice dodge takes three overlapping forms. The first, a particular Obama specialty, is the false choice. Set up two unacceptable extremes that no one is seriously advocating and position yourself as a champion of the reasonable middle ground between these unidentified straw men. Doesn't he do that all the time? There's always some boogeyman over here, boogeyman over there. He's right in the middle, being the reasonable one. Again, no details or specifics. This guy can't ever give us any details. So, like, when it came to health care, let's go all the way back to the campaign. Here's what Obama said. He said, I reject the tired old debate that says we have to choose between two extremes, government-run health care with higher taxes or insurance companies without rules denying people coverage. The tired old debate? Whoever debated that? Whoever said, I want health care with higher taxes, and the other person across the aisle said, no, I want insurance companies with unlimited rules? There's no such thing. So they're false choices. They don't exist. It's also a choice that no one, certainly no other politician was proposing. No people were proposing it. No pundits were proposing any of those things. He picks two things that never existed, don't exist, and won't ever exist, and stands up there and pounds his fist. He has no substance. He completely lacks substance. All right, let's get another example here. How about the president on financial reform? We need not choose between a chaotic and unforgiving capitalism and an oppressive government-run economy. Actually, that's exactly what he wants, but, you know, whatever. This is a false choice. So he even says it. He uses the term false choice. You're right, Mr. President. They're false choices. Why are you bringing them up? Okay, he said, this is a false choice that will not serve our people or any people. Boy, you're exactly right about that. Why are you bothering talking about it? That's like me saying, you know, let's say I was the president of the United States, and I hold a press conference, and I say, listen, everybody, we got a couple choices here. If the moon were actually made of cheese, we would have to figure out a way to get up there and start harvesting that cheese, because we've got a lot of starving people on the planet. But if it turns out it's not made of cheese, then we really don't have to do anything. But we got to choose. We got to choose what we're going to do. I mean, it's nonsensical. The guy makes this stuff up. And it's to sound like he can be tough, or I'm not on the left, I'm not on the right, I'm right in the middle. When in fact he is well over to the left. Now this is the second category she talked about, a false choice rhetoric, obscuring the difficulty in divining the correct answer to a complicated problem. She says, like the president, I'm ideologically and temperamentally inclined to middle ground, but the frame of the false choice does little to clarify the correct choice. And his Libya speech offered a classic example of that, you know, where he talks about, you know, well, we've got to go in and save lives, but we're not here for regime change. He's going to, I think, regret that one, because he's now there for regime change. That's absolutely clear. But, you know, we're there for humanitarian purposes, but not for regime change. So, you know, well, what is the answer? And the thing is, we're in there already. So, you know, that was other part of this thing. It's like, you know, we don't want to have to go in there, but we're already in there, Mr. President. We're already there. Now he's saying, well, we're not. And now this leads right into the War Powers Resolution. And this was by John Samples at the Cato Institute. I'm going to read you a quote, and you've heard me say this one before, Paula. So don't give the answer. But anybody out there that's listening, you know, who do you think said this? The Constitution supposes what the history of all governments demonstrates, that the executive is the branch of power most interested in war. That's the president. That's who wants to go to war. That's who wants to. And look at this. We've got a president who got a Nobel Peace Prize for what he's going to do in the future. Not what he's ever done, but what he's going to do in the future. And what did he do? Took us to war. So this individual was absolutely right. The branch of government that's most interested in war is the president, and our Nobel Peace Prize winning president took us to war. It has accordingly, with studied care, vested the question of war in the legislature. So in other words, the Constitution, which you start out saying, supposes, therefore the Constitution has vested the question of war in the legislature. Only the legislature can declare war. Is it declaring war if you go in and bomb Libya, but you just drop bombs? Well, we're just dropping some bombs. A few bombs here, a few bombs there. Maybe we'll hit something, maybe we won't. Is that war? I say it's war. I say any time you're using our military to shoot and kill people of another military, that's war. But now we have a president who's saying, oh, no, that's not. Oh, we're not at war. We're just kind of hanging out with NATO and doing some training exercises. Well, you know, last week was the 60th day since the president notified Congress that U.S. military forces had commenced operations. And, and get this, in an international effort authorized by the United Nations, not our Congress, but the United Nations. So the president puts authorization of the United Nations above that of our own Congress, our representatives. And now this is costing us money. The president has cost us about $750 million so far. We're approaching a billion mark. $750 million in our efforts in Libya. To me, that sounds like taxation without representation. My congressman didn't vote for that, didn't approve that, didn't appropriate the money for that. Did yours, Paula?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
No, absolutely not. Taxation without representation. Our president's violating all kinds of constitutional enumerations here. But anyway, let's see. It was to prevent a humanitarian catastrophe and address the threat posed. There are humanitarian catastrophes all over the planet. How come our military's not running all over the planet dropping bombs everywhere else? Anyway, but the War Powers Resolution of 1973, and I reiterate this, it's called the War Powers Resolution, not War Powers Act, but people call it the Act. Said within 60 days of notifying Congress of the use of force, the president shall terminate the use unless Congress has declared war or authorized the use of force. Now, this is what this article says, but the problem is this. He can't go in there on day one, period, unless Congress has authorized the use of force, declared war, or the president believes and has reason to believe and has proof that the United States of America is in imminent danger. I don't know about those that Libyan military fighting the rebels. I mean, they're barely hanging on. I don't see how we in the U.S., you know, 7,000 miles away, are in imminent danger from that little skirmish over there. Do you, Paula?
I do not know.
No. So he violated the terms of the War Power Resolution, but he said when he notified Congress that we've commenced, he said that, you know, in accordance with the War Powers Resolution. So he was saying that he was operating within accordance when he wasn't. All he was really doing was notifying them. See, he's supposed to notify them. So he went in without any justification, but he did comply with the notification portion of it. Wow, he's really going out of his way to follow the law and the Constitution. So, you know, this article was written just before the time expired, but she wrote, you know, with a few hours ago, I doubt he will stop American air attacks in Libya. Indeed, the attacks have spread to Libyan ships. Go ahead.
Right, and just a short time ago, Press TV put out a piece that said, I don't know if you've ever heard of international and human rights lawyer Paul Wolf. He mentioned that the U.S. military's involvement in NATO attacks in Libya on May the 20th has no legal basis since it is not authorized by Congress. And he went on to touch upon the War Powers Resolution as you had. And he mentioned that it's quite amazing that U.S. President Barack Obama has not gone to Congress and asked for this authorization, because chances are he would probably get it. For our listeners out there that are not aware, NATO launched a major air campaign against the forces of the Libya regime in mid-March under a UN mandate to protect the Libyan population. The United States, France, and Britain say they will not stop their military operation until Libyan ruler Muammar Gaddafi is removed from power. The Western coalition airstrikes have claimed the lives of scores of civilians, and Libyan revolutionary forces have also frequently criticized NATO for its failure to prevent Gaddafi's troops from killing civilians. A revolution against Gaddafi began in Libya in mid-February.
Yeah. Well, the quote I read at the beginning was James Madison, the author of our Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And what I will say to kind of wrap this up is Michael Ramsey, a legal scholar, wrote this. Every major figure from the founding era, so we're going back to, you know, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson's time, every figure from the founding era who commented on the matter, on the president's ability to just go in and start fighting somebody, gave Congress the exclusive power to commit the nation to hostilities. Notably, this included not only people with reservations about presidential power, such as James Madison, Thomas Jefferson. They were very reluctant to, they wanted to use their presidential power as little as possible. There are times they had to, but they did it within the construct of the Constitution. But also strong advocates of the president's prerogatives, such as George Washington, the father of our country, Alexander Hamilton. Man, by the end, before he died in a duel, he hated democracy. He wanted a very strong centralized government, and yet he was clear on this, and I'll get to that, but President Washington on several occasions said that he could not undertake offensive military actions without Congress's approval. Hamilton is especially significant because his views on the need for a strong executive went far beyond those of his contemporaries. He was way off the spectrum compared to James Madison, Thomas Jefferson in terms of what the president could do. He wanted the president to be able to do a lot. And yet Hamilton made it clear that he read the Constitution not to allow the president to begin a war. As he put it at one point, it belongs to the Congress only to go to war. Okay, so it's very clear that what this president has done has violated the Constitution. The War Powers Resolution was written to ensure that it couldn't be further misinterpreted, and yet we've got a guy, you know, another slimy lawyer. Sorry if you're a lawyer listening to this, but not all lawyers are slimy. But we got another slimy lawyer in the presidency in the White House who is snaking his way around through the language and in and out between the lines to come up with a way to do whatever he wants.
Mm-hmm.
This is absolutely impeachable. It won't happen, I know that. But, you know, back in 2007, here's what Obama himself said. He said, the president does not have the power under the Constitution to unilaterally authorize a military attack in a situation that does not involve stopping an actual or imminent threat to our nation. So So he said it in 2000. He's not even following his own advice, and this is the danger of this guy. This is the danger of this administration. When he says, Israel, don't worry, we got your back. Give away half of your country, we've got your back. Look what he does. He says one thing, that the president has no authority to just go and attack a country, and then he jumps. When the United Nations calls, he jumps, yes, sir, right to it, and launches our military into an unconstitutional effort that violates not only federal law, but obviously the Constitution itself. So what this person suggests in this article, and let me make sure I've got the person's name right here, John Samples. Mm-hmm. From the Cato Institute, is the War Powers Resolution never worked in practice as intended. It's now moribund and should be replaced by a new effort in the courts or Congress, and I disagree with that, not the courts. Please, no, not the courts. Congress needs to basically rewrite the War Powers Resolution and make it very, very clear. The president has no authority to execute a military effort without the approval of Congress, unless the actual territory of the United, and they're going to have to come up with a clear way of saying this, because what this administration said in the beginning was, we are in imminent danger, because if we don't go into Libya, there are a lot of terrorists all around the world who will be mad at us for not going in and saving the poor little rebels, and they will attack us here in the U.S. So we are in imminent danger. I mean, that's the most convoluted concept ever. So we need to come up with a language that will say no, no, no to this kind of stuff. There are times when I think it's appropriate to go and do what we're doing in Libya, but we've got to do it within the rule of law. We've got a president who does not follow the rule of law and has established a pattern of violating the rule of law month after month after month. So he said, Congress to apply the original public meaning of the Constitution. Yes, I absolutely agree with that, and thereby right the balance between starting and making war. Absolutely. Absolutely. So there we have it. We've marched through all of that stuff, and Libya keeps coming up, and it's an important thing. Even though there may not be much changing over there, and it may not be affecting us that much, and maybe oil prices have stabilized, people have to really understand that this is a severe violation of the authority of the presidency, and it cannot go unchecked. It really can't. We've got to – Congress needs to step up and cut him off and say, no, you are no longer authorized for this action. We are not giving you approval. Get out now. Stop. And he'll have to. I mean, he'll have no choice.
Yeah.
And you know, people say, well, he's commander-in-chief. He has authority to go do this stuff. First of all, the Constitution doesn't say that. But second of all, well, who would be second in command in the military? Maybe the leader of the Joint Chiefs? Does he have the authority to declare war or to take the military into action? I mean, we've got military leaders around the world that command entire fleets of ships and aircraft. Do they get to decide, hey, there's a conflict going on over here. I don't know that Washington knows about this. Let's just go in and drop some bombs. Of course not. So he's the leader of the military, just like there are other leaders within the military. None of them have authority to just go drop bombs without Congress's approval. He's no different than any other military leader. He's just the head military guy. And the Congress gives him no authority. It'd be one thing if the Constitution said something about this. It said, you know, in certain situations, the president may have to, you know, take some military action. But it doesn't. And the Tenth Amendment makes it very clear. If it doesn't say it, you can't do it. So I love the way, you know, he says that to assist an international effort authorized by the United Nations. Oh, authorized by the UN. Well, that then it's A-OK. Perfect. Oh, but not authorized. And here's the thing. Here's what the article should have said. But not authorized by the Congress. Our president chooses the United Nations over our legislature, the people that represent the people. Ay, ay, ay. Boy, I need to get rid of this guy. So I think the last article you sent me this morning, Paula, was about balancing the budget without cutting spending. This is something we've talked about many times, but it was an interesting article that I think came from the Heritage Foundation. You want to talk about that?
Oh, no, you go right ahead. You take that one.
Okay. Well, we'll keep it pretty brief because we're just about done for the day. But, you know, we're running massive deficits, and a balanced budget requirement. This is what I've said back when I was campaigning for Congress. You can have a balanced budget, but if you're spending like out of control, what does a balanced budget mean? It means you got to take more money from the people. See, a balanced budget just means you can't spend more than you're taking in. Well, if you want to have a bigger budget, you just have to take in more money. That means more taxes for you and me, Paula, and everybody else, and then our kids and everybody else. It just starts piling up and piling up. So the answer is, it's not just a balanced budget. It's got to be a capped budget, a percentage of GDP or some other such number, but it's got to be capped. Okay. So one of the things that I always harping on is cutting the size of the federal government. We constantly talk, and even this article from the Heritage Foundation said that, you know, without serious entitlement and other spending reforms, entitlement's always on the tip of their lips, you know? And then there's that, like, other, kind of like other spending reforms. What are the other spending reforms? How about the $1.3 trillion a year that we spend on the federal government, just the administrative infrastructure of the federal government? Yes, there are some non-mandatory military and national security spending in there that really are pork going to various states to pad the reelection of our different congressmen and senators. So I've analyzed a lot of those non-defense or non-mandatory defense spending programs and even wrote an op-ed about a year ago on one of them that was just absolutely unnecessary. And there's a lot of waste there. So the reality is this. We don't have to touch Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and even the military as it is right now. And we could still reduce our annual deficit to zero, just by significantly scaling back programs like the Department of Energy, Department of Interior. I mean, nobody's going to be riding in the streets over this stuff. And, of course, you know, unfortunately, our politicians are proposing a 5% across-the-board cut, and they can't even get that passed. I'd propose an 80% across-the-board cut. I guarantee you, you wouldn't see a change. You wouldn't see hardly a change in what's going on in the country. And it would really – so here's the bottom line. We talked about this earlier today, Paula, you and I, in private. But the bottom line is what our government keeps telling us is we just can't keep the government the same size it is without more of your money. Because we can't keep going into debt. We know that. Nobody wants to keep going, driving our country into debt. So the only way we can keep our government the same size it is, because that's the most important thing in the world, is to take more of your money.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they want to do. They don't want to shrink the size of government. They're crack addicts when it comes to their government programs and pork. And therefore, the government's going to stay the same it is or shrink very minutely. But we're going to see Republicans at some point go, sorry, but the only way to get out from under this debt is to raise taxes. How about you cut your salary in half, sir or ma'am? And how about you eliminate some of these wasteful programs in the federal government? Oh, no, we can't do that. That would, you know, people would be screaming. Really? I don't think so. So that's what the article really was entitled, Balancing the Budget Without Cutting Spending Would Cause Taxes to Skyrocket. And that's exactly it. We can balance a budget and keep it the same size it is with Mr. Obama's new baseline of a $1.5 trillion deficit. We can make that deficit go away, and it would take a significant raise in taxes. In fact, we know that the people that make over $250,000 right now, we could not even eliminate the annual deficit by taking every dime that everybody from 250 and over makes, not raising their taxes, just taking every ounce of their income. We still can't eliminate the deficit that this president is running. So there's a lot to be cut, a lot. And the final thing I'd say is this: Obamacare is one of the things that's going to drive that up. We talked about this. I want to finish with this, Paul, because we didn't really talk about. I touched it a little bit on the article about the president using the false choices.
Mm-hmm.
But why is it that when the Democrats cut $500 billion out of Medicare, that's A-okay? But when Paul Ryan proposes cutting nothing out of Medicare, he's throwing the seniors over the cliff. How is that possible? Not cutting Medicare is screwing our seniors, but cutting it by $500 billion, that's helping them out. Does that make any sense?
It doesn't make any sense at all. And I think I heard something to the effect of somebody said, well, they could start giving out vouchers when they're 55 or something. But I don't understand how that helps them. I can't wrap my head around
by
that.
By giving them what, vouchers?
By giving them vouchers at 55.
Well, here's what they're talking about. If you and I went out in the open market to buy insurance, we'll say it would cost $15,000 for the year.
Okay.
I know that what American Airlines pays for my annual health care cost to have insurance, and I still pay a monthly premium on top of that. But they pay about $12,500, and it may have gone up a little bit. And then I pay about $185 a month.
And that's
to have
per?
What I consider to be that's for the
that's,
family.
That's yeah, but that's per employee. Right?
Per employee, that's, yeah, that covers their entire family. So now what we're saying is for a senior, and I believe what he proposes, each senior, not each family, but each senior. So it could be a husband and wife, would each get a $15,000 voucher. They could go out and buy a family plan that would be a $30,000 plan. I mean, that's a Cadillac plan right there. They'd have virtually no co-pays or monthly costs there. They would go to an insurance company and go, like, here's my voucher, or here's our vouchers. We want a family plan for the two of us. We want insurance, health care insurance. And they'd be covered with a plan much, much better than Medicare. I mean, Medicare is a black hole. It's a pit that is unsustainable. So for liberals to say, oh, we're throwing Granny under the bus, okay, I tell you what, let's just keep doing what we're doing. You're going to throw not only Granny under the bus, but me and everybody behind me, because there will be no – it's unsustainable. It's going to be bankrupt in 8 more years.
Yeah.
So what's their plan? They have no plan. But my real point is this. How is it that for anybody 55 and older today, nothing changes, no cuts to Medicare?
Nope.
But – for everybody 55 and older today, under the Obamacare plan, $500 billion is being sucked right out of Medicare. How is that not throwing seniors under the bus, but Paul Ryan's plan throwing seniors under the bus? It's not. It's completely backwards. The media is deceiving people, lying to people, and, of course, our liberals are lying to people as well, putting together these TV ads that show Paul Ryan throwing some poor old woman off a cliff. When in fact, they've already done it. What somebody needs to run an ad is like Paul Ryan pushing an empty wheelchair and saying, boy, somebody already threw her off the cliff. Oh, that's right, it was the Democrats. Yeah, they already did that. That's exactly it. So anyway.
Sorry.
Well, fun as always, Paula, and I'm glad that it worked out well. Like I said, I haven't been here in Peru in 6 years, and the broadcast worked out fine. May have to come back here sometime soon for the ceviche, and because it's definitely better here than anywhere else. It's amazing. They say it's in the kind of lemons they use. The ones they grow here are just a little bit different than anywhere else, and that's what causes it. That's what they say. I've tried some. I've been to restaurants owned by Peruvian families, and they're the ones doing the cooking, and still not as good, outside of Peru. So it's really weird. And you could ask anybody that's ever been here. Ask if you run into somebody that's ever been here and had some good ceviche. Ask them, is it different there in Lima than elsewhere? And I guarantee you they'll say, for some reason, yeah, it's just not the same anywhere else. So just one of those things. But anyway, tomorrow it's going to be a surprise broadcast. I don't know which one I'm going to pick, and maybe you have a suggestion, Paul, but it's going to be one of our favorites, one of our top ones rebroadcast, because it's just not going to work out. And then I forgot to mention two things here, two important things. Michael Cutler is going to be filling in for me on Thursday because I'm flying again Thursday. I'm flying down to Ecuador, and I could broadcast, but I'd be doing it in the car while I'm driving to the airport or, again, on the train. I don't want to have to drive down. I'd rather take the train, so it's just not going to work out. But Michael Cutler was more than happy, and we're going to have him fill in once or twice a month for me just to get him back in the seat of broadcasting so that sometime in the next few months, hopefully, he will start his own broadcast on the USA Talk Radio Network. Michael Cutler, if you haven't heard him, he was on our show this last Monday. Last Monday, a week ago. Great show, fantastic guy. If you think I can talk, I shouldn't say that. He can talk, man, and he's smart. He knows a lot about a lot of different things, but 30-year INS officer, and I'm sure he'll want to talk about Israel and what's going on with the negotiations there. And I know, and you know him. You've gotten to meet him now, Paula, and he's a smart guy, fun guy, and he's a funny guy too. So I hope the two of you have a good time on Thursday. I'll be back Friday. I can fly back into Miami around noon, so we'll be broadcasting live just before the weekend. I will be, again, at the Tyco Air Museum, the Warbird Museum, this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, in Titusville, Florida. We're doing a Memorial Day open house. Great museum there with all kinds of actual planes. You know, out, two big hangars full of planes, five airplanes, different airplanes that I flew when I was in the Navy, and all kinds of other warbirds from all the different eras of all the way going back to World War One. So if you're in the area, please come on out. And then we will be broadcasting on Monday, Memorial Day. And I realize if that's a holiday and you know, you're going to have be out with the family and that kind of thing. But we've got Joe Goldner, who is running for District 20 in Florida against our most not favorite incumbent politician in the world, Debbie What's-Her-Name Schultz. District 20, Florida, and she's now the new DNC chair, so she's going to do both jobs equally as bad as just doing one job. So that's good for us on the Republican side. Debbie What's-Her-Name Schultz, that's who he's taking on, and we just had Karen Harrington, she's also in that race, yesterday on the show. So don't miss that. And then finally, take a look at the website, usaradionetwork.com, and also on Facebook, The American Hour Radio Show. I put some information about Joan Flowers, our good friend who's been working so hard for so many years to get her father buried in Arlington. And we're a step closer, and I think we're going to maybe get it worked out here. But the problem is she spent so much money on this that she's really broke, and she's just trying to eat. So April 19th, you can hear the show. You can see some of her comments on our Facebook page. You can find her on, I think, Twitter. I believe it's at Flowers Joan, and see some of her comments about her father, et cetera. We'd like to help her out. So if you can help out, send an email to me at The American Hour Show. It's all one word, theamericanhourshow@gmail.com. And I will get you in touch with her. I'll get you her address so that you could send her a little something to help out. If you happen to live in the Chicago area, go buy some groceries and drop them off for her. You know, this is for real. This is somebody that we know and we'd like to help out. So please help out if you can. Send me an email at theamericanhourshow@gmail.com. The email's right there on the website. And hopefully we can help her out. And we'll talk about this a little bit again on Friday. But everybody have a good night. Paula, thanks for joining me today. And take the day off tomorrow, at least from this show. And then enjoy the show with Michael Cutler. I look forward to listening to it after the fact on Thursday. And then I'll see you again on Friday.
All right. You have a good rest of your week and a safe flight. And I'll talk to you on Friday.
Okay. Sounds good. Take care, Paula.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
You're listening to The American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.